Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It's Justin Cuthbert and it's Jesse Rubinoff this morning. Our maiden voyage.
What's going on? Happy to be here.
Not much. Just another Monday morning. Monday mornings, because you've done this shift a couple times. We're talking about it before. But Monday morning's the most difficult because the body won't let you get to sleep.
That's
so dealing with
one.
A little bit of a shorthand 100%. On Mondays.
That's a tough one. You always want to try and get some early rest or get to bed earlier than normal when you know you're getting up for the morning show the next day.
Yeah.
And your body just says, absolutely not happening. So you're just rolling around all Sunday night into the wee hours of Monday morning. And then you get up. We got to bring the heat today.
Yeah, it's your best, your best efforts kind of work against you in that sense. Like you try to do your best, but it's like a baby or a toddler going to bed. Like if it's too soon, it's going to be rough, right?
Yeah.
But if it's the right time or you push it just a little bit and accept, you're going to have a little less sleep on a Monday morning because that's the reality, then it's maybe a little bit easier.
I did make a concerted effort yesterday to stop the caffeine intake by like 1 p.m.
Which sucks on a Sunday. You want to be doing that all day long on a Sunday.
I know. But
so Sundays are four.
Usually when I, if I work at night or whatever around here, working on Sports and Central, I'll have my last coffee at like 3.
Mm.
And that'll sustain me for the rest of the night. And then yesterday I tried to cut it off. Didn't matter. Did not matter.
No, didn't matter.
No, you got to cut it off a lot earlier than
that. Didn't matter whatsoever. No. You've been a busy guy. You've been going around town. You've been on location for us all last week at the National Bank Open.
Yeah.
You have any National Bank Open takeaways after Sinner and Pegula win the men's and women's respectively? A busy week for you guys. You guys weren't broadcasting on the weekend, but I'm sure you're able to see and hear some pretty cool things.
Yeah, first of all, shout out to Devang Desai, who is the co-host for the week, and Tristan Marchigiani, who is the producer on the show, and a lot of great help from a lot of different people and great guests throughout the week. One big takeaway, these guys are really good, man. Like, the tennis players are very, very good, and you see them up close. I made the comparison to, a big golf fan, and I went to, whenever you go see the Canadian Open and whatever, there's a different sound when guys swing the golf club,
right,
than the amateurs. And tennis was the same way. There's a different pop off the racket, and you start to get a sense of just how fit you have to be, really, to be a professional tennis player.
Yeah.
It's just practice for hours and hours and hours, and that's before they go out and play their match. And obviously, there were some weather issues over the course of the 2 weeks, but it was hot at different times last week, and they're playing in 30-degree heat just for hours. At that level is ridiculous.
And, like, obviously we gave Milos Raonic his flowers last week, gets 2 wins at the National Bank Open, but just kind of not cold because he played at Wimbledon and he's been around a little bit, but making kind of this unexpected, impromptu is maybe the wrong word, but unexpected. And he kind of just shows up and then you're beating guys. You're beating a 10th ranked in the world, Tiafoe, where it's just like, how do you just come off the couch and do something like that, understanding the fitness level? But, he looks like he's still in great shape and was able to get it done in the way that he did before he, ran out of gas, ran into someone who could actually, handle that serve and beat him. But yeah, you're right about that. I mean, the fitness level and how everything's so calculated, right? Because the National Bank Open is important. I mean, Sinner's first win, Masters 1000 win, which is very important to put under your belt.
Totally.
But this is also part of the ramp up process to the U.S. Open, and everything's calculated in terms of energy expenditure and getting to peak at the right time. And the National Bank Open is definitely a part of that process on the hard court. And cool to see guys, some people are taking it a little bit of a different route, and some people have maybe more ambition. People are working on things at this event, as opposed to, putting everything out there. But when you factor all that stuff in, just watching those guys, and again, I'm kind of using your words here because I've never seen it up close, but you can tell when you're around it, which is the different level, that it is, in fact, that different level.
No, it's a really good point, too. Again, Novak Djokovic was not a part of the National Bank Open this year because of fatigue, is what he said, right? So you just get a sense of how drained these guys are. And Novak was coming off that ridiculous Wimbledon final against Carlos Alcaraz. And I guess that's another one of my takeaways from the week, is that there is a real electricity and buzz when it comes to Carlos Alcaraz. Mm-hmm. Tennis is searching for who that next person they're going to put up on a pedestal is. And it seems like Carlos Alcaraz has been the one that's anointed.
Yeah.
And now you saw with Jannik Sinner winning yesterday, there are a cluster. There's a group there that can challenge Alcaraz without a doubt. There's the Sinners and the Tsitsipases and the Holger Runas and the Casper Ruuds. They are an excellent crop of young players, but walking around the grounds of the National Bank Open on days where Carlos Alcaraz was playing, you knew that's why most people were there, because this guy has charisma. He has the talent. It felt like his career took another massive step with the win over Djokovic at Wimbledon. And it feels like he's the type of guy that, you don't want to put too much expectation on the kid. He's just 20 years old. But it feels like he's the one that could not challenge the Grand Slam record. But if there is one player of a generation that's going to win a lot of Grand Slams, it seems like it's going to be Carlos Alcaraz.
Yeah, and I guess it's important then that, you know, the guy he identified as potentially his foil, if they're coming up over the next 10 years in Sinner, gets the victory. Gets a victory that he didn't have before a Masters 1000 victory, because if you're going to be someone who's going to be a rival or considered anything even close to a rival, getting some victories is probably pretty important, but getting some head-to-head victories maybe would be the thing that would really set you up.
Mm-hmm.
But for now, bragging rights goes to Tommy Paul, who was able to knock Carlos Alcaraz out of the tournament on Friday night. I didn't see much of the happenings in Montreal because it was just a disaster from a weather perspective.
It really was.
Even if you plan to, you might be a little disappointed because you were running into weather and really some difficult issues that they had to work through. Samsonova, who lost in the final, played twice on Sunday, played twice on Friday. She really did not have much of a chance, but not to diminish Jessica Pegula, who, as I mentioned, the champion in Montreal at the National Bank Open. Okay, so it's, you know, this time of year is interesting, right? Because, you know, people still taking vacations. The Blue Jays are obviously playing their most important games of the season before they get to their next most important games of the season in September. But there's a bit of a change in feeling, at least that I go through every year around this time, mid-August, where it's like, okay, you can see the finish line on summer. You can start to anticipate and ready yourself for other things. So from a sporting standpoint, Jesse, what are you excited about when you're considering the changing seasons, what's ahead, what we've gone through to this point, and what, you know, the sports calendar? I don't know if it officially starts at any time, but if I had to answer that question or answer my own question, I'd probably say Labor Day is when the sports calendar kind of starts, because everything starts anew in the fall. And of course, you get the NFL season. So if we're doing like, okay, times are about to change here, at least in the sporting landscape, and what we're going to be talking about from a day to day, what does have you excited about what's ahead?
Yeah, no, I think you're bang on. Like, there's really two parts of the calendar that really kick into high gear. It's the April, like March and April, when March Madness is going on. You have the Masters in April that really kicks off golf season. And then October and September and October when football season really gets going. Yeah. So if I'm looking at things that are coming up, the fantasy draft football league chat is fired up, trying to figure out all the details for the draft coming up. NFL preseason got into high gear this weekend. So there's that. And of course, the pennant race, which just feels like what an interesting year to be a Toronto Blue Jay fan, because it just feels like the expectations, they haven't met them, despite the fact that they're where they are in the standings, currently in a playoff spot and 12 games above 500. But there's a level of pressure watching baseball as you get to this time of the year. And that's what I'm feeling, even watching the games over the course of the weekend. Like, there's a different intensity that I even watch it with, even following the team. So I would say football, for one, kicking it up a notch, and baseball coming down the stretch here.
It was an interesting weekend in terms of, I guess, the specter of Bautista, the context of Bautista, the memories, the recollections, comparing feelings. I think that's a big one, right? Because 2015, if we're doing like landmark moments in my like sports consuming life, it's right there near the top, because it was completely different, right? Like, you and I are probably around the same age. We are around the same age, and we probably don't remember 92, 93, if at all. I think you were around for it. I was definitely around for it, but we're not consciously viewing that. And when you're growing up and that was something that was, you know, it happened a few years ago, but you weren't a part of, you're just seeing the same team in the 2000s and the, I guess, the 2010s, early 2010s, sort of running into the same wall. Like, a lot of seasons, they were very competitive, but they were not even fourth best, or they were not even second best.
Brutal
in the division.
Jerseys too, for being
and
honest.
And they had brutal jerseys, and the vibes were just not as good, right? But it seemed like there was a hard ceiling, and the guy who broke them or helped them break that ceiling was Bautista. Like, I think if there's a legacy, and I guess I didn't answer my question, but we can circle back on, and we should go to Bautista now, is the legacy for me is that he made things possible, right? When he first showed up, it was like, oh, you don't even notice it. I definitely did not even blink when it happened. But when you start hitting 54 home runs, it's like, okay, we don't have the team success yet, but we've got something that other teams don't have. We got the home run king in the major leagues, leads the league in home runs back-to-back seasons. Like, okay, things are possible. And then you start to build around Jose Bautista, and you build it up towards 2015 and 16, where they have the sort of success, and they give you the sort of memories, and they give you the sort of moments that you never had before, unless you were conscious and alive and a fan in 92 and 93. So I really think that's the legacy for me, and that's why it made it so interesting. And so it stops you in your tracks watching on Saturday. And granted, I didn't have a chance to watch Saturday, watched it in full on Sunday. Sportsnet YouTube page has it all. You should watch it if you haven't, because the memories that you go through and the times you had, it brought me to this conclusion, which is it doesn't feel the same right now.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, it does not feel like it did in 2015 right now. And it's probably because you don't have Jose Bautista, and you don't have Eddie, and you don't have Josh Donaldson, and the lineup just isn't as good. They do some things better than they did. They certainly pitch better than they did. But for whatever reason, the baseball is important, and you're dialed in, and you're locked in, and it feels big. But it doesn't feel like 2015, at least for me.
Yeah, it's like until there's a team that can surpass what the 2015-16 Toronto Blue Jays did, that is going to be the standard of this generation, right? And you're bang on. Jose Bautista, when he came over, he had topped out with the Pirates of 16 home runs. This was not expected of him what transpired, right? And he was traded for Robinson Diaz, who finished in two seasons with one home run. Think of the difference there. What a deal that was made by the Toronto Blue Jays. But he kind of like put them on the map, similar to I think about Vince Carter and how people always talk about Vince Carter putting the Toronto Raptors on the map. It's not that Bautista, they weren't in the same trajectory in franchises, obviously. The Raptors were very, very new. But the Blue Jays were going through the doldrums, this chunk of 20-ish years where they really struggled, the 22-year playoff drought.
Yep.
And once Bautista came over, and then you had the deadline moves to bring over the Tulos and the David Prices, that really, I think, ratcheted things up even more and started to get you to believe, okay, this team is actually serious. And when you ask Bautista now and you talk to him about the teams where he really thought he had a chance, that 2015 team was extraordinary. And he looks back on that and says, that was the one that I think got away. Mm-hmm. Over the weekend, prior to the Bautista ceremony, I was with a couple of buddies over the weekend, and we watched the seventh inning in its entirety on YouTube. And dude, that has to be the most remarkable, definitely seventh inning in the history of baseball, if not one of the craziest innings in all of baseball, whatever it was, 55 minutes, just Jeff Bannister running out of the dugout every 2 seconds, fans throwing things, which I don't obviously condone, but nonetheless, I was in the building for that, and it was an electric, electric atmosphere. When I think about Jose Bautista and putting the Blue Jays back on the map, there was this ferocity and intensity that he, and I think Josh Donaldson played a big role in that as well. But Bautista had this glare that really showed you, okay, we're the Toronto Blue Jays. We're not going to be pushed around. We're not going to be messed with. And I think that goes a long way. And I don't know if I see that in this team currently.
Yeah. Definitely not. Yeah. Definitely not. Like, and that's the thing. He is kind of one of a kind, so maybe that's too much to ask
for.
And to a certain extent. But other teams right now have things that the Blue Jays don't have. But no, I don't think any team right now has what Jose Bautista gave to the Toronto Blue Jays. And yeah, you're right. I mean, I don't think 2015 happens without, you know, Bautista sort of changing what it meant or changing what the expectations were, almost demanding, probably tacitly, probably with his performance, probably maybe a little bit with his words. What we saw and what we will cling to, I think we're going to be clinging to 2015 because it happened at the right time in our lives forever.
Yeah.
Like I don't, watching the seventh inning is probably going to happen 20 years, 25 years, probably be showing kids one day what the seventh inning was and why it meant so much. I mean, it is one of the truly memorable and landmark sports moments in our lives. And of course, Bautista, you know, was at the heart of it and, you know, bat flipping his way through it. So he will always be front and center. He will always be there in our minds, and he's obviously going to live forever in the level of excellence, which is truly a great honor. When you watched the ceremony, what was the number one thing that stood out to you?
I think the class with which the organization handled it, I thought was, it was spectacular. It was about 40-minute ceremony, and to have former teammates contributing and the video tributes and Edwin being there, being a part of it. And now he's back in the dugout in full uniform, special advisor role, which I thought was really cool. But I wasn't expecting Jose to be as emotional as he was either, which kind of made me a little bit emotional, and probably the same for everybody else watching. Because when you think of Jose Bautista, again, you think of this super intense, ferocious competitor. But then at the end of the day, when he's looking back on all the memories and all the things he contributed to this city, to this country, to this organization, he certainly got choked up. And I would have liked him to not wear the sunglasses and just like enjoy it, live it, and show us.
But
show
that's kind of Jose, right?
That is Jose.
Like, I was going to say veteran move wearing the because he knew.
Yeah.
But Jose is not a guy who shows weakness, right?
No.
And maybe like maybe that was part of his success, like a refusal to be vulnerable in a lot of ways, because he always had to be on, because he didn't have the skills that a lot of guys had. It wasn't can't miss. Like, he had to kind of be and act bigger than he was in order to be as big as he was, if that makes any sense.
And
equating sunglasses and crying at a ceremony is maybe a little bit of a stretch, but it kind of feels Jose to me to a certain extent. So I kind of thought it was pretty apt.
Even with his batting stance, like with the way he like covered almost all of his face with his left arm and only had the eyes staring down into the pitcher. Like, there was such an intimidation factor there that anytime he came out to the plate, even I think back to like the stretching, the back stretches prior to walking into the batter's box, like he became basically an icon in this city and in this country. When they brought him over, that was the biggest afterthought possible. Like, you thought you were getting a utility guy, and then he goes out and hits 54 home runs out of absolute nowhere, and you said it, that basically completely altered the trajectory of those early 2010 teams, because they were not expected to compete. They were kind of middling. The ugly jerseys.
They were even a little bit worse than they were.
Yeah.
It felt hopeless before that, but even with him hitting those home runs, I guess I'd have to pull it up. But like, it wasn't leading to great success. It was individual success. It was like, okay, are we going to have the team success that followed? And I think without that individual success, the team success probably doesn't, because maybe there's no impetus to build, because you finally had someone and you weren't expecting to have someone with the, you know, making that really, really low level trade at the time you did.
I started in my career here as an intern with Blue Jay Central in like 2011, 2012. And I remember nights like a Tuesday night against the Minnesota Twins. Like, there was nobody in the building. There was no buzz. There was no electricity. There was nothing going on. And then the stark contrast of those years versus, I think, when they started making the moves, the Jose Reyes move and the Mark Burley move and the Josh Johnson, those didn't pan out. But at least they were trying.
Yeah, that was exciting.
I remember where I was when those trades dropped, right? I remember sitting on the couch
too,
refreshing Twitter and being like, what the heck just happened, right? And that at least proved that they were trying to accelerate the process a little bit. And then Jose, when he had his big years, that was the real catalyst to those competitive 2015, 16 years where they were in the ALCS. And it feels like, especially the 2015 team, really should have won a World Series. Like, it feels like we look back on, at least for our generation, because you said we weren't consciously watching 92, 93. It feels like those are the teams that we hold up on the biggest pedestal as teams that are essentially almost World Series champions, even though they win the American League.
That was definitely part of it. Like, it's not bittersweet at all. I mean, that was like 98% sweet. But when you think back on 2015, it's all good memories, but it also should have been, right? Because one of my big takeaways from the weekend was like, I don't think we knew how good we had it because, it wasn't like a perfect lineup. It was damn good though in 2015. And Eddie and Josh, who, you know, you didn't see any Donaldson this weekend, which may be a little disappointing, but you see Eddie, you see the relationship he has with Jose. it wasn't like you came up together. It wasn't as though it's the Bo and Vlad of 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. These guys were a little bit more advanced, but what a partnership they had and what a team they were able to build around them. And it is disappointing looking back that they didn't win. But one of my big takeaways from the weekend is we kind of, I'll ask you, did you know how good we had it when it was 2015? Like, we knew how exciting it was in the moment that summer where they're hitting all those home runs. Mm-hmm. They were very average until they weren't, until they made some moves and everything sort of came together. But I feel like it was supposed to be with Bo and Vlad. It was supposed to be the same thing. It was supposed to feel the same way and has not felt the same way yet. But even then, looking back, I don't think we knew in the moment how special it really was, because you can try to do your best to get back to that point with a new crop of players, yeah, and there's no assurances, there's no promises. And it feels like, despite how high we hold it in regard, we still didn't even know how good it was in the moment.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. Like, we always tend to look back on the past and past successes with incredibly rose-colored glasses, right? And I remember, you think about all the flack that the current Blue Jays front office takes from the fan base, and sometimes it's justified, and other times it may not be. But people now, when they talk about Alex Anthopoulos, they consider him to be one of the great executives in the history of this country, right?
And he's had some success.
He has. Yeah. There's no question. But at the time, prior to those moves, prior to the David Price moves, prior to the Troy Tulowitzki, he was much maligned. And mm-hmm. people forget that, right? Yes, he had incredible success with those moves. But it's not like he was incredible the entire way through. And I think people forget that oftentimes. Like, they long for things from the past. Do you long for someone with the personality of Bautista in the lineup, like we were talking about? You long for Alex Anthopoulos to swing for the fences. But there were some tough times with Alex Anthopoulos at the helm too. I remember being at season ticket holder meetings where fans were irate about the direction of the team, but people don't talk about that anymore. They don't remember that. They talk about the successes, and that's what we tend to do after success. You look back and you say, wow, how amazing that was, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not always that way. You also have to, I think, sprinkle in and remember the times that also weren't so good.
Yeah, I mean, the two easiest things to do in like any sport, if you're a general manager, is to, you know, accrue futures assets to sell off, yeah, and to spend them, to go all in, right? Like, if you just have the currency, you generally can spend it. What's hard is balancing the two. And that's what this new management team has been trying to do, mm-hmm, basically since it arrived, right? That is the most difficult thing, is to have an elite team, but not have it come at the cost of everything else. And fortunately for Alex Anthopoulos, who I do worry is like, this is sort of a Kyle Dubas parallel, where it's like, okay, you clearly, you came up and you learned some things and you took some knocks at your first stop. Yeah. I don't know if it's the exact first stop, but your first major, major gig where you had the controls and you make mistakes and you have success. And then we long for you because, hey, you've had greater success after, because you learned a thing or two at your first stop, right? Like, sometimes we were talking to, I think it was Barker, and he says, you know, your third team, that's where you have your success as a pitcher. And it sucks for the second team, right? Because yeah, you help get them, yeah, to the point where they're just about to make that their inroads, where you did a lot of the legwork and you don't get any credit for it. Or you don't get any of the flowers for it. And of course, Alex Anthopoulos, will, as you mentioned, we look back on him fondly. We look back maybe longing that he was still here in a lot of ways, or at least we did a little bit earlier, you know, right after his departure. But in some ways, he maybe needed to move on. Maybe to be the best general manager, he had to be in a different spot. Maybe he had to learn what he learned here with the Blue Jays. I fear that might be the same thing with Kyle Dubas, but not to make everything a Leaf discussion. That's kind of how it goes sometimes.
Yeah.
And with Anthopoulos, yeah, pushing all the chips on the table, it's kind of the easy thing. And if you can be remembered for pushing the chips on the table and bringing good memories to a franchise, well, I guess that's a good position to be in.
Yeah, I think much of the frustration, I think, with this current front office, like, Anthopoulos is loved in large part because he was able to push the chips to the middle and it worked out for him. And this front office, I think what they're struggling with at this current point in time is they haven't fully gone for it with the moves that they've made, but they also have diminished the farm system more than they have really at any point of their tenure which is a little bit concerning from a Blue Jays fan perspective, right? Because they were lauded for, like you said, having a balance of success with the big club, but also having a sustainable farm system that where the cupboards are not bare. And currently, they're in the lower third, if not the bottom 10, in terms of farm system rankings among the major leagues. So I think the frustration for me when I look at what they've done over the last number of deadlines is, at what point did you ever really fully jump in with both feet? Because if you're going to diminish the farm system, why not just completely diminish it and at least give your big club the very best chance to win, right? And you can say, yeah, well, they went out and got the best reliever at the trade deadline, Jordan Hicks, and that is true. But then you also should have done your very best to go out and get, I don't know if the best hitter is fair, but why jump in with only, why only dip your toe in the deep end, right? So I think that is a criticism that I would have of the front office at this current point in time. But also, they're still a very good team. And I think the front office probably has higher expectations than what this team has shown you. And that's probably why they didn't make moves. They probably said, we think we're good enough. Because why would they go out and get a rental in Jordan Hicks if they didn't, right? And they may have tried to do more. But this team, I think in their eyes, still has what it takes to probably compete for a World Series title.
What's clear is they're trying to win in a different way than 2015. They're trying to club their way to a World Series in 2015. If they had even a semblance of what we have now from a pitching standpoint, it might have been a wrap, right? Yeah. Like, because they were that good offensively. But there are multiple ways to win, and it looks like they want to go one direction clearly, and they went that way at the deadline, adding to what was already a strength. But if you look at this weekend, I mean, Kevin Biggio, Davis Schneider, and Kevin Biggio being your fifth hitters over the course of three games, like, it's not scaring many people. No. And when half the lineup is, we were talking about that this last week, for the most part, hitting sub 225, sub 250, that's easy. If you're a guy like Justin Steele, to work through more often than not, and you're going to be seeing nothing generally that but good pitching in playoff games. And if playoff starters, playoff relievers get a chance to go through real soft lineups with regularity, it's going to put it makes the margins thin, and it's going to put a lot of pressure on pitchers to be perfect. And who wasn't perfect this weekend? Jose Berríos and Chris Bassitt.
Yep.
And they lost the Chris Bassitt and Jose Berríos starts. And thankfully, the offense did come around on Sunday, and Hyunjin Ryu was able to give them as good or better performance than what we saw previously, and it resulted at least in salvaging one. We'll get to that in a second, but just want to go a little bit more on the level of excellence in Saturday with Jose Bautista. The gifts. He gave us a lot. He got a lot in return. He's got the mural on 99 Spadina that will live forever, apparently, which is awesome. He gets some Muskoka chairs, a big donation. But the one that's on the tip of everyone's tongue is the pendant, the diamond pendant. It's awesome. It's very cool. Number 19 with a bat, a little Blue Jays logo.
Yeah.
I don't know how many diamonds there are in it, but I'm going to guess upwards of 100 is probably a safe bet.
It's like a Super Bowl ring.
But it had me thinking, like, okay, you know, Super Bowl rings, exactly, change over time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you see a guy who was playing in 1972. I think they were playing Super Bowls in 1972. Yeah. Anyway, one of the first Super Bowl rings ever given out. If you see it on an old guy's hand, it's small. It's pretty muted. It's not exactly that flashy. It might look like a university ring or something like that. So I was thinking, like, okay, what A did they give a guy like Dave Steeb? What did Dave Steeb get in terms of gifts? Because it wasn't a pendant that has 100 diamonds.
Yeah.
And what exactly, like, what would be the request, like, does Bautista request, hey, give me a little jewelry? That's what I'm looking for. I want to know what Dave Steeb got. I looked it up. I couldn't find anything. But a hug and maybe Muskoka chairs. Maybe doing Muskoka chairs at that point. But I think the gifts are going to continue to evolve, and they evolved and peaked at a pretty good time for Jose Bautista, because that thing's probably worth a lot of money.
Yeah, the closest thing that I can think of seeing a pendant like that is when Sauce Gardner, I think, recently gave Aaron Rodgers a diamond pendant just for joining the Jets,
which is
hilarious. Different standards for getting a pendant in that case. Bautista will never wear that, right? Like, what do you do? That's what I always wonder with jewelry of that magnitude. Like, even a World Series ring or a ring for any of the major sports, when you win, like, what do you do with it? Because it's so big and so out there that, like, you can't go out to, like, a a restaurant and wear that pendant around your neck.
I mean, you could.
Like, where? Like, what are you getting? It's ridiculous.
Super Bowl ring's tough because, like, if you're at a restaurant, you wouldn't be able to eat dinner wearing it.
Correct.
Like, it would end up in the sauce. Like, yeah. I don't know how he would, I don't know how you'd be able to do that. I guess he could wear that. Maybe he wears it because he doesn't have a World Series ring with the Blue Jays to, like, any future Blue Jays related events. I guess he could.
Just keep it in a safe somewhere on like, just on a shelf. And that's all he can do.
It could probably send his four daughters to college.
Exactly.
If you need it, I don't think. But he's kind of an understated guy. I mean, we caught up with him at Joe Carter's golf classic earlier in the summer, and we had a chance to talk to Jose and Joe at the same time. It was amazing. The two guys who hit the most famous home runs in Blue Jays history, but also Major League history, maybe top 10, both in, maybe not top 10, but, you know, pretty close. Two really memorable moments, and they're kind of having a laugh. But my thing from him was, or my takeaway from Jose was, he's kind of, he's not a flashy guy at all. It wasn't like he's larger than life. He feels larger than life, like in my mind, right? But he wasn't like that. It was kind of understated. So not that, one conversation in my mind should preclude him from ever wearing that thing. But I don't know if he's going to be like hanging out in Florida, you just walking down the street and going out flashing that thing all the time. But that is a pretty cool gift.
Maybe they missed. Maybe they should have spoken to Jose before and said, you're not as flashy, so you probably shouldn't be getting this, because that certainly doesn't seem like it matches an understated personality. That thing is just ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. Well, they're talking about how this like new lake house, like I love when they give like boats out to someone.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, enjoy this boat. Like, I want a boat. If it was me, I don't even have access to like a boat ramp or whatever they're called, but I want a boat. I want someone to give me a boat one day. And I guess Jose Bautista maybe missed his chance there. Quickly, you get Eddie there, John Gibbons there. I think those are maybe the two most people wanted to see. They get a huge pop. Russell Martin does as well. Hazel May, by the way, stunting with multiple languages. Awesome.
Ridiculous performance.
She did such a great job. But was there anything missing for you?
Probably Donaldson, not, hearing from him. And I know that he's still active and he's playing for a division rival, which probably precludes it. But when I think of those teams, that's who I think about. I think about the Bautista-Donaldson combo. I think about the bat flip. And I also think about the Donaldson slide. And they were all sort of together in that, and I would have liked to hear a little bit from Josh Donaldson, but I thought all in all they gave him it was an incredible ceremony. They did a fantastic job and he got his due. Like, if you're thinking about a guy who deserved that kind of love, Jose Bautista in this market was that guy, and I just thought it was just all around good for everybody to see.
Yeah, it didn't look like Jose was shortchanged whatsoever, right? Like, maybe, I'm thinking, oh, where's Josh? But, like, it didn't feel like that mattered much to Bautista, who was, as you mentioned, overcome a few times. And it just felt like the right people were there and the right people sent messages in. And you mentioned it. I mean, the Blue Jays themselves did such an incredible job.
It wasn't overkill either, too, which I think is important. Like, I was concerned a little bit because we were hearing so much in the lead up to it. And then he had the one day retirement press conference, signing the contract with the Jays. And I just got worried, like, are we just going to hear too much about Jose Bautista this weekend? Is that even possible? But I don't think it was too much. Like, the pendant might be too much, but other than that, like 40 minutes is not that crazy. And I think it was just class all around. So a job well done for the Blue Jays there.
Certainly was. We will talk to Ben Ennis and Caitlin McGrath. Ben at 7, Caitlin at 8. We'll continue the discussion about Bautista and also the weekend that was for the Blue Jays. And we'll touch on that ourselves just a little bit here. We talked about Berríos and Bassett not having what they needed, which is near perfection when you're pitching in front of a Blue Jays offense that has been anemic like it has.
Frustrating.
You mentioned concern with, where we might be going with Bautista in the ceremony, how long they can last. I was concerned about the Blue Jays' place in the wild card race Saturday after the loss, but three straight results went their way after three straight results went the other way in the Mariners' favor. So they still have that 1.5 game advantage over the Mariners after the Mariners lost their last two games to the Orioles. And of course, the Blue Jays winning on Sunday. I mean, Ryu officially supplants Manoa in terms of the rotation, which goes down to 5 with the 17-17. Now in the rear view, they go 9-8. From what was, a lot of information thrown at us, maybe the culmination of events, a hard break in the schedule coming up, which is a 2-game set with Philly midweek here. Is there something that is hitting you over the head in terms of, like, number one, forefront of your mind, this is the most important thing happening with the Blue Jays right now?
Well, I think they got to get healthy, number one. And I think, by and large, they have been really lucky with the health that they've had this season. Like, the pitching rotation, you've talked about just how they've been just about the best in Major League Baseball. But when you look at their injuries, there haven't really been that many to the rotation. Obviously, Bo being out really hurts you. So to get him back, I think having Bo out really exposed this team offensively. But then you have days like yesterday where you're like, why can't they do that all of the time, right? They haven't. When they made the trade-off from last year's team with the power and they decided that they were going to relinquish some power to be better defensively and maybe focus a little bit more on pitching, you thought, okay, where are the runs going to come from? And finally, yesterday, you get a big three-run home run, which has been so rare for this team. And I think that when you have the pitching that this team has, I'm always going to have that little bit of hope, that flame that's going to continue to flicker, that if they can just string together hits and have maybe a big swing here and there, which shouldn't be asking that much because it's not like they're not talented, right? At the beginning of the year, if I showed you the lineup, I guess with the exception when Bo's hurt and you have Kevin Biggio and David Schneider in the three hole, that changes things, right?
Mm.
But if I had showed you the lineup in April, I think almost everybody was like, this is a good team.
It can hang.
With a lot of potential in the lineup itself, mm-hmm. right? So I think that when you have the pitching and you have the names that you have in this lineup, I'm always going to have hope that they can turn things around and win in the postseason, because pitching and defense is what rocks it come October time, and they have that in spades for sure.
Yeah, why didn't they win in 2015? I mean, they ran into bullpens that even the best lineups that you could put out there could be handled, right? Mm. By the pitching and especially the relieving that we saw from a team like the Kansas City Royals. I don't know how realistic it was that Cody Bellinger would land with the Blue Jays, but he was the perfect fit.
I know.
A reclamation project.
I know.
A lefty with power, a former MVP.
He's so nice, too.
Doing things that Simeon did in terms of, like, hey, you want to recoup value? Come to us. Yeah. Come play for the Toronto Blue Jays.
They got hot, though, right at the deadline, and they decided they were going to trade anybody.
Yeah, and I don't think they were going to get him at the deadline, but if he was Brendan Belt,
right?
If he was the guy that they got in the offseason to do the things that Brendan Belt was brought into, mm-hmm. maybe Brendan Belt was the contingency plan. Maybe he was the number one plan A all along. But if Cody Bellinger was in this lineup, it would look so much different, right? Because Cody Bellinger was the best hitter in the series, and he was by far the best hitter in the series. And he was the guy who, you know, even took mistakes or non-mistakes out of the yard, but, you know, fear in the heart, a guy who actually comes to the plate and you're like, okay, I gotta watch his at bat, mm-hmm. right? Like, it just felt a little bit different, his at bats versus everybody else. And Vladimir Guerrero Jr., despite a productive Sunday, I mean, that's supposed to be our Vladdy. Bellinger, yep. I guess. And he, what again, productive on Sunday, non-productive Friday, Saturday. That's exactly how the weekend went for the Blue Jays. And just the lack of extra base power from him it's hitting you over the head, or it's hitting me over the head at this point in the year. So it's fear of missing out. Was it even possible at all? Just like how one more bat could change the complexion of things. Yeah. And they don't grow on trees. But there was one that fell off a tree in Cody Bellinger that might have been available to you. And again, it maybe didn't want to be here. There's no chance. But I'm watching that thinking, if the right move was made there, if you were aggressive at the deadline, it feels like they're one bat away. Why did that not happen?
Totally. It goes back to what I said before with the front office sort of being half in. Like, why not go out and get a bat that solidifies the lineup? Because and credit to Brandon Belt, because he's been really good. But to have Brandon Belt in your three hole is not necessarily striking fear in opposing pitchers.
He's done what a guy hitting seventh should do to make sure the balance is there and the on base is at the depths of the line. Not a three hitter.
Totally. And when you have, I think, when you have struggles around guys who are in the meat of the order, it puts pressure on the Vladdies and the Bos to really perform. Like, Bo has been almost at an MVP level this year, but every time Vladdy comes up to the plate and hits a ground ball to short, that gets magnified because of the struggles for the rest of the team, right? I think if the team was performing offensively and they were near even in the middle of the pack in most offensive categories, you wouldn't have fans just jumping all over Vladdy all of the time because they'd still be winning and they'd still be putting up runs. Yes, he'd be getting his fair share of criticism, but now it's just over and over and over again, and it's a byproduct of not having strength and runs contributed from the rest of the lineup too, right? If you had the 6, 7, 8 guys performing as well, you wouldn't be having these conversations about guys in the meat of the order. So, yeah, I think things could be turning a little bit here. Like, Whit Merrifield continues to be just amazing. A revelation. He's been back to when he led the league twice in hits with the Kansas City Royals. Like, he has been that good. And it's helped paper over a lot of the deficiencies that the team has felt with Bo being hurt. But I said when Bo got hurt, I think this team is going to really struggle to score runs, similar to the Yankees when they lost Judge. Because when they lost Judge is when the season really went off the rails, and rightfully so. He's arguably the best hitter in the game. But they just could not score at all. And when they took Bo out of this lineup originally, that's what I thought was going to happen. And for the most part, it has. Yesterday was the exception. So if you can get Bo back, I think it really does wonders. And maybe this team can get off to the races a little bit here. I'm not sure how much you've seen to suggest that that actually will happen. But when you have a team that's top 5 in the league in batting average and bottom 5 in the league in runners in scoring position, it's just, you start to wonder, like, does it normalize a little bit over the last couple months of the season here, month and a half of the season, or is it just going to remain a statistical anomaly for the rest of the season? And that's the major question that we're going to have answered in the last month and a half. And if they can normalize that a little bit, then they're going to be right there.
The hope obviously has to have the former, that the important base hits will come in the important moments. 49 at-bats for Vladdy in the month, 4 extra base hits, yep. 1 home run. It has not been a hitting bonanza from Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Not that we were expecting anything post-home run derby, but it was something going to change? Is a positive regression? Not really sure what you were counting on, but it has not happened. It's been a lot of what we have seen through the balance of this year. I think credit to, before we move off the Blue Jays, should go to Hyunjin Ryu. Just his third start, I mean, sort of by default, he's supplanted Alek Manoah, because Manoah has sort of done it to himself here. But even having to being removed from that Cleveland Guardians start after 4 innings, he has shown enough for me to be number 5, to have a role on this team. I don't know what it's going to mean for September, late September playoffs. I'm not sure if there's a role there, but credit to him, because he made a lot of money when he signed with the Toronto Blue Jays. And he didn't even have to do what he's doing right now. He kind of could have mailed it in, right? Like, not to say that you could put yourself in a position where the contract is terminated and you don't get paid the money that is owed to you. But he didn't have to work, I guess, as hard as he did to be here for the final 2 months. And now he's going to play a pretty sizable role in getting them into the postseason. Excuse me, after we entered the year thinking, at least I thought, there's no chance he's going to have any discernible impact on this team and on this race. And he is penciled in, penned, permanent marker, whatever you want to say, into that fifth role right now. He has outpitched Alek Manoah. He might outpitch other guys down the stretch. And if he does, that would be a great thing.
Yeah, they needed a pleasant surprise, this team did. And whenever someone's coming back from an injury of that magnitude, he had been off for over a year, you always want to caution what you can expect from that guy, right? And you think, like, if they get anything, this was at least my mentality, I think you're the same way, if they can get anything from Hyunjin Ryu this season, then that's going to be a plus. And this guy has come in, and in 3 starts, he has a 2.57 ERA, and this is coming back from Tommy John surgery. This team needed someone to step up, and he has come in and given them 5 guys that you can roll out there, and you have I should say, not even just a chance to win, but you could almost be favored every time any of the pitchers go out there. That's how good this rotation has been. And it's allowed you to send Alek Manoah down. It's allowed you to not have a guy in the rotation who's going to be consistently inconsistent.
A repeat of last year, right, where every fifth day you feel like you're going to lose.
Right, which is what was happening early in the year with Alek Manoah. And they sent him down and brought him back up, and you thought that there was maybe a chance that he was going to turn things around. And this was not a time for experimenting with Alek Manoah. This is the time where the Blue Jays have to try their best to win games here in the middle of August mm-hmm. and then into September and October. You have to you owe it to the team to give yourselves the best chance to win possible every single night out. And Hyunjin Ryu, the choice is clear after even just three starts. He gives you a better chance to win baseball games than Alek Manoah does, and it's a pleasant surprise.
I'll give you what I'm excited about with, you know, changing in seasons or changing in sports seasons ahead. You know, I will settle for contracts between Austin Matthews and William Nylander. But, like, the training or the media day, start of training camp, the angst if neither is dealt with. Like, it's gonna be fun to talk
about.
I'm a sicko, but I want to talk about it. We need something from Austin Matthews by the end of summer, before he shows up in Toronto. There's gonna be something, right? And if there's something, it'll be interesting. So either way, like, this is starting to build in my mind, and it's like, I think I want to applaud the city of Toronto for just, like, playing it cool here with Austin Matthews. Yeah. Like, it could be everyone could be pulling their hair out right now. They're not, for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if the right insider said the right thing that just cooled everyone off. But this could get loud soon if it isn't dealt with. And it feels like the clock isn't ticking, clearly. And there shouldn't be any angst because we've been told there shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. But it just feels like something's got to go here at a certain point.
So which one would you be more concerned about between Matthews and Nylander? Because for me, Nylander is the one that feels like is more urgent. Look, Matthews, from everything we've been hearing, mm-hmm. to your point, they've been saying, the insider has been saying, there's nothing to worry about here. But Nylander hasn't had the same vibe. It hasn't really come out that they're close in any respect. There's always been that, like, at least $2 million gap in what Nylander is asking for and what the Leafs think he's worth. So that one for me would be the big, big, big talking point going into training camp if he still doesn't have a contract.
I guess it depends on what the priority is. Like, Austin Matthews, like, he holds this organization in the palm of his hands. Like, whatever he wants to do. And I guess we've been led to believe that he just wants to be here. And he'll be here. If it's too much money, it doesn't really matter. He's here. I think you're going to make those concessions. I guess it's Nylander, but I'm more worried about overreacting to the current situation. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see him traded. I think the most valuable thing, maybe to this team in 23-24, is the fact that William Nylander is one of the best players in the world, one of the best offensive weapons in the division, in the conference, in the league, is going to be paid way under market value for one more year. And if you give up on that, if you trade him away because you can't get a contract done for 24-25 mm-hmm. and beyond, well, then you miss the forest for the trees. Like, you need to use what you have, which is the final season of him being a guy, not making or breaking the bank. Use that to your advantage. I would like to see some patience. If they let another team use William Nylander for under $7 million, it's a mistake, in my opinion. So I'm worried about an overreaction to him having that hard stance. I'm not really worried about them. Like, if they don't get a contract done with him, am I going to be freaking out? No, because I think you can play it like Pasternak. And if he wants to leave and you lose him for nothing, yeah, that's bad. But at least you had this season.
Yeah, I think that is an excellent point. And I'll contrast it to where the Toronto Raptors were with Fred VanVleet, for example, and not re-signing him and losing him for nothing. The frustration there was that they weren't expected to compete and they didn't have a chance to win. So you're thinking, like,
spending on him could have been worse than the alternative.
Right. And why not trade him? Because you're not going to win. What's the point of keeping him? Like, why even try to re-sign him? Why even risk losing him for nothing? Mm-hmm. But the Leafs are in a different spot. Because they are expected to win. They are expected to compete. So if you have William Nylander, to your point on that incredible deal, Nylander in a contract year with the skills that he has, knowing that he, if he has a good year, could command, $11 million moving forward in his next contract. So if you get 45, maybe even 50 goals from William Nylander, he walks at the end of the year if you can't re-sign him, but you're going to be a really good team if you get that kind of production from William Nylander. So I don't think going into this year and not having him signed is the biggest deal in the world, because you have a motivated William Nylander that should do wonders for your organization.
We got to hit a break. We have a goofy Canadian sports moment after the break in the A-list. Goofy Canadian sports moments, like, we're not immune to them. They happen. I mean, I guess for it to be a Canadian sports moment, it has to be specific to us. But weird things happen when Canadians are doing sports, and a weird thing happened at the National Bank Open in Montreal. We'll do that in the A-list next.
Sportsnet 590, the Fan. Now it's time for the A-list.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
Sup,
Okay, got to be real quick with this because we don't have much time. But the most critical moment, arguably a tiebreak, Iga Swiatek and Jessica Pegula in the semifinal, and considering what happened in the final, probably, you know, maybe the tournament on the line. The one of the wackiest things that I've heard at a sporting event in like we just saw Adam Hadwin get tackled on the 18th green at the RBC Canadian Open. This might top it in terms of wacky moments. We have the audio. I can't say it better than we can play it.
Oh wow! Cotton Eye Joe just came on mid rally.
I love how like, it sounds like it stops and then starts again.
That's the best part by far. It had to be deliberate at that point. Now, if it's restarting, then someone has to be pressing the button. How does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, there's no break in Cotton Eye Joe. Like, there's no, like, someone tried to turn it off or someone restarted it. It's just...
It is the best possible song too that could play. Like, I couldn't handpick a better
song. Nothing would be more goofy than that.
It's the best comedy song you could possibly play. It's not a comedy by any stretch of the imagination. It's a dance song, but to have that play is just remarkable. Unbelievable.
We've gotten more serious about sports here, I think, in the last 20 years, but it just feels like a Canadian thing to happen that Cotton Eye Joe came out or came on in the most important moment at the National Bank Open, at least in Montreal. We're going to talk about that with Eugene Bouchard at 8:30. She was tweeting about it, so we'll ask her about it. Cotton Eye Joe. But up next, we got Ben Ennis to discuss Jose Bautista's legacy, his weekend, and of course, the Toronto Blue Jays. We'll do that next.